thank you, everybody, for taking the time out of your evening tonight to join in for this WebEx. This is a talk about management of advanced urothelial carcinoma. And the field really has changed a lot. And one of the things that we need to discuss now as part of our treatment is the role of biomarkers and biomarker testing, which is something that is relatively new in this field. And I'll just try to page down here. All right. The faculty for this program included myself and Kala Sridhar from Princess Margaret, and we have a faculty that includes uro-oncologists, pathologists, as well as medical oncologists who put together this program. And the work that we're presenting today in this WebEx is really the sum total of the products of a lot of effort from people across the country to develop some information about the emerging field of uro-oncology and the role of biomarkers in bladder cancer. These are my disclosures. It is important to note a disclosure of financial support. This program is being supported by Janssen in the form of an unrestricted educational grant. And as well, the work that we will be discussing tonight is an output of the GE Research Consortium, which is a group of interested academic and community oncologists and uro-oncologists from across the country, in which we work on all aspects of urothelial and prostate cancer, and this consortium is also funded in part by Janssen. The learning objectives for this program tonight are to review the Canadian GE Research Consortium's algorithm for advanced urothelial carcinoma, which has some changes in it with regards to some of the things that we are contemplating for treatment recommendations and practice guidance, and also to review the optimal timing of how we might want to implement biomarker testing in bladder cancer, including the role of FGF testing and PD-L1 testing, which is something that's relatively new to this space. And part of the mandate, as well as per Health Canada, when a new drug is coming onto the market, and there is a new drug now with an FGFR inhibitor called erdafitinib, is that we have an obligation to make sure that the treating community is educated on the agent, both in terms of the data that supports its use, but also on the safe prescribing of that agent. And so we will spend some time during this WebEx discussing this new medication and how it's prescribed, how it's dosed, and how its toxicities are monitored. To start off, I will review for us the management algorithm that the GE Research Consortium has been working on and developing. First of all, it'll be no surprise to this audience or new information to this audience that we have a large number of treatment options for urothelial carcinoma. And really, from the systemic therapy perspective, we're really talking tonight about the advanced patient population, those with muscle-invasive disease and beyond. And the standard guidelines across the world for people with muscle-invasive bladder cancer who are considered to be surgically operable is that if you are contemplating a radical cystectomy and node dissection as the standard of care treatment for the local management of the bladder, wherever possible, we would consider those patients as well for neoadjuvant chemotherapy. And that neoadjuvant treatment must be cisplatin-based combination treatment. And the reason for this is because there are a large number of clinical trials as well as meta-analyses that all show a consistent signal of about a 5 to 6% improvement in overall survival. However, if an individual cannot receive cisplatin, then carboplatin-based regimens are basically ineffective as a perioperative management strategy, and you wouldn't waste time giving carboplatin-based treatment if the patient was cisplatin ineligible and you would simply pursue your immediate surgical intervention. For individuals who either don't want surgery or can't have it because they're medically inoperable, then chemoradiotherapy to treat the bladder is certainly an alternative in appropriately selected patients. Therefore, these people really do benefit from a multidisciplinary case conference before definitive decisions about management of the bladder are made. And if an individual is fit and would be going for chemoradiotherapy because they simply don't want to have a radical cystectomy, it is not unreasonable to have a conversation about neoadjuvant treatment as well. If an individual has gone forth with their surgery for whatever reason and has not received neoadjuvant treatment, then we can have a case-by-case conversation about adjuvant treatment post-operatively with the understanding that the level of evidence and the magnitude of benefit is not as good, and therefore many people may choose not to take post-operative adjuvant therapy. Now, at the bottom of this slide, are the patients with locally advanced or metastatic disease who are really not usually going forward with any type of local intervention. They're not getting a cystectomy or chemoradiotherapy because they're metastatic. And in those individuals, we would typically look at first-line systemic therapy with chemotherapy. And other guidelines across the world, including the US and Europe, would advocate that immunotherapy could be a first-line option for patients if they are ineligible for cisplatin. The evidence is there to support this, but as I'll point out in a couple of other slides, part of our challenge in Canada is that there's no funding in place for first-line immunotherapy, so we really are a little bit limited in that scope and can only offer people chemo treatment. However, patients with metastatic disease are invariably going to progress. There are very few people who are going to receive a complete response that is durable with chemotherapy. And therefore, we need to think forward about second and third line treatment options, because we do have enough options on the table that patients are able to receive second and third line treatment. And what we'll see is that as we get into some of those lines of therapy beyond chemo, we now have to think about biomarker testing to be able to appropriately select patients for those treatments. Therefore, the landscape of therapy has really changed dramatically in the last couple of years. If you look back to what I would consider the historical treatments, which are really chemotherapy, up until about 2016, there were no advances in the treatment of urothelial carcinoma, except for different ways to give chemotherapy drugs. The original MVAC papers were back in the 80s, and we were basically trying to modify those drugs to improve the toxicity, but nothing really new came about until after 2016, when we finally began to have approvals for immunotherapy. And the checkpoint inhibitors have really been the biggest substantive change in bladder cancer treatment in a generation, and with their use in second and third line therapy, as well as where available in first line for cisplatin ineligible patients, they've really revolutionized the treatment of this disease, because the toxicity profiles are better than some of our chemotherapy agents, and the efficacy is as well. Now, once we get into the contemporary era, 2018, 2019, and 20, and so forth, we are now starting to see the emergence of a whole multitude of other agents, some of which, as we'll discuss today, do require biomarker testing. And therefore, we need to think about how we will logically and rationally approach managing these patients and doing testing to minimize the delays in accessing the pathology results that we need to be able to access the treatments that the patients will require. Now, I want to let us reflect on a theoretical case. And these are by no means unusual circumstances, I'm sure, in your various practices. You've got a retired male patient who is in his mid-60s, who has a prior smoking history, and he goes to his primary care physician because of hematuria, as well as urinary urgency and frequency. He's noted to have hematuria in his urinalysis, he's sent to a urologist, and he has a transurethral resection confirming a clinical T3 disease state with negative imaging. So this is a man who's got a muscle invasive urothelial carcinoma with no evidence of distant metastases. So what are his options? And there are a number of different options that could be on the table. We may offer this man a neoadjuvant cisplatin-based chemotherapy followed by surgery. Or he may be medically unfit, or he may refuse that surgery. So another option could be chemoradiotherapy with or without neoadjuvant chemo. Perhaps he doesn't want to wait around and he's concerned about surgical wait times and you've got a cancellation, so you choose to do an immediate cystectomy and consider adjuvant treatment after with a view to whatever the pathology report was. Or would this man be eligible for immunotherapy right off the beginning? If you think about these options, and we're not going to take time to do a poll, but really the first three options are all reasonable options with a shared decision-making model with the patient. Certainly if surgery is in the cards for this man and he's fit, we would like to do preoperative chemo followed by surgery, because that's where there's strong evidence of survival benefit. But if he chose to have radiotherapy instead of surgery to treat his bladder because he didn't want to have a urinary diversion, we could certainly go with option number B. Some individuals will still proceed immediately to cystectomy, either patient choice, perhaps they don't believe that the benefits of neoadjuvant chemo are worth it for them, And we still see individuals who present with significant hematuria or pain and don't really have the time to wait for a 12-week course of treatment before surgery, and so they proceed immediately to that cystectomy. The only thing that we wouldn't do is offer immunotherapy to a muscle-invasive patient who is basically sitting in this neoadjuvant space before there is a cystectomy planned. We don't have any clinical data from research trials at this point that would show that immunotherapy as a strategy in that perioperative or upfront setting makes a difference. And in fact, there are some negative clinical trials that are just reporting, at least in press release form, for the adjuvant setting, and many other trials still ongoing in this space with immunotherapy. So it's not a standard of care for the patient with curative intent muscle-invasive bladder cancer. Now, if we go to this potential algorithm, this is what the GE Research Consortium has been working on. And if you start off at the top of this slide where the transurethral resection is being performed, at that point in time, we basically started the algorithm off by saying you're identifying a patient with muscle-invasive disease. That's really the disease entity of interest for this part of the algorithm. And then a decision will be made about how to manage that individual's bladder definitively, whether it will be a cystectomy or whether it will be with radiotherapy. If the decision has been made to proceed with a cystectomy, wherever possible, we would like to do neoadjuvant cisplatin-based combination chemotherapy before we get to the surgical intervention, because that's where there is proof of benefit for survival. We can debate about whether there is one particular kind of chemotherapy that's better or another, but the bottom line is that it should be cisplatin-based and it's combination therapy, whether it's dosed denthemvac or gemcitabine. Those are debates that rage on and on within the medical oncology community. Then our patient has his cystectomy and we will have the opportunity for a definitive pathologic evaluation. And at that point in time, we can determine if there's any adverse pathological features. So do you still have persistence of disease that's beyond the bladder, such as T4 disease? Are there lymph nodes that are grossly or microscopically involved? Is there LVI? What the group in the algorithm testing decided was reasonable was that if an individual has adverse pathological features, it would be reasonable at this point in time to suggest that that cystectomy specimen be sent off for reflex testing for PD-L1. This would be something that would be managed at the level of the pathologist who would identify that there were adverse pathologic features and initiate the reflex testing. This would be important because it may help guide in the future some decisions with regards to choices of therapy if the patient becomes metastatic, if some of the readouts of other clinical trials that are underway do demonstrate that PD-L1 status for first-line immunotherapy treatment would be required. Now, the other consideration is that if this patient has adverse pathologic features and never had the opportunity to have neoadjuvant chemotherapy for whatever reason, then you could have a conversation with them about adjuvant treatment. But if they've received neoadjuvant chemo, we are not giving them more post-operative chemo. You either do it pre or you do it post, but you don't do both. For the individual who is on the right-hand side of this diagram pursuing trimodality therapy, you're not going to have any cystectomy specimen that you can send off for reflex testing. So basically, you're going to have your transurethral resection that identifies muscle-invasive disease, and the patient will then proceed on to simply start their radiotherapy with chemosensitizing agents like cisplatin. And if they have a good response, you finish your full course of treatment. If they have a poor response and they still are a surgical candidate and they were simply hoping to avoid surgery, they would have that bailout point to go for the cystectomy and hopefully achieve a curative intent. And finally, once all of the patients, whether they choose trimodality or surgical intervention, complete their treatment, they would go on to follow up. So the big thing that we wanted to highlight from the research consortium here is that we are advocating that we consider having reflex testing built into the algorithm for patients undergoing cystectomy who have adverse pathologic features, because we recognize that they may be at a higher risk of developing metastatic disease in the future, and you would want that information. Moving later in the disease trajectory, you would have individuals who now unfortunately have metastatic disease. And some of these individuals will have had metastatic disease after prior local intervention, such as a cystectomy, and there will be a minority of patients who will present with initial metastatic disease. So there's going to be a group of individuals who already have their PD-L1 status known, because if they had a cystectomy with adverse features, we will have sent it off for pathology. But there may be a group of individuals who didn't have adverse features who we will then have to request testing. Or there may be those individuals who present initially as a metastatic patient who perhaps are going to have a TUR to assess and diagnose, or perhaps they'll have a biopsy of a visceral or a nodal metastasis. So you'll need to then at that point have on-demand testing for PD-L1 if you have never achieved it before. Now, as the patient initiates their first-line metastatic therapy, we recognize that that's going to not be 100% of people who were initially diagnosed with bladder cancer. So we're culling down a little bit, and now we're identifying those people who have got an incurable disease, who may go through one, two, or three lines of therapy, and recognizing that at some point that FGFR mutation may be required to know what the status of that is for treatment decisions. We have recommended in the algorithm that when the patient starts their first line therapy for metastatic disease, we request on-demand testing for FGFR status, because it may take several weeks to get these results back, and therefore you can have that, you know, cooking in the queue while you're treating the patient with their first line therapy. And once you embark on first line therapy, there are basically three types of patient populations. There are those who are cisplatin eligible on the left-hand side of this diagram, and for them, the standard of care today is still chemotherapy with cisplatin and gemcitabine. There are some chemoimmunotherapy studies which have reported out showing some positive results, but they're still not approved at the level of Health Canada or any regulatory authority for a first-line therapy. So we would still look at cisplatin being our standard of care. In the middle, you may have a group of patients who are cisplatin ineligible, but you would still feel confident of giving them some chemo, like carboplatin-based regimens. Maybe these are men and women with poor renal function or neuropathy or borderline performance status, but you feel you can give them carboplatin, but you can't give them cisplatin. The algorithm is broken down here based upon PD-L1 positivity, which we know from the reflex testing that we did before. And the reason this is there is because there is clinical trial data showing that if you are cisplatin ineligible, but you are PD-L1 positive, you're better off getting immunotherapy as opposed to other kinds of chemotherapy. But if you're PD-L1 negative, you don't benefit, and so you would stick with chemo. We feel it's important that we have this in the algorithm because the trial data is there. Health Canada has approved it. We don't have funding in place, but part of our role is to advocate for the things that we think that patients should have access to. And I'm a firm believer that they should have access to first-line immunotherapy if they are cisplatin ineligible and PD-L1 positive. There may be patients with private insurance or perhaps some who feel that they really want to self-pay for this, so it's important to have this in the algorithm as an option. And then on the far right, there are going to be those individuals who are completely ineligible for platinum chemotherapy. These may be people who could then get gemcitabine monotherapy, or as an alternative, if we could get first-line immunotherapy, that would be a preferred strategy than very grossly inferior chemo. And lastly, on the algorithm, what we have done is looked at now our patients moving into the second line and beyond of therapy, and broken them down by what their previous treatment has been. So if you're second line, we want to ask ourselves the questions, have you ever had immunotherapy or not? And what is your FGFR status? And this is why we wanted to do it as a test at the first line so that we have the results back when it's time to make a decision about second line. If you're someone who's never had any immunotherapy before, so you're IO naive, if your FGFR gene mutation is positive, then you have a choice. You can either have immunotherapy or an FGFR inhibitor. The group still felt strongly that IO therapy was preferred because of the strength of the randomized data in this setting. But if you are an FGFR gene alteration negative patient, it's a non-discussion because you don't qualify for an FGFR inhibitor and your treatment is going to be immunotherapy. If you have already seen immunotherapy, perhaps as part of a clinical trial when you got it in the first line setting, based upon whether or not your alteration for FGFR is present or absent, you could either qualify to receive an FGFR inhibitor or a standard second or third line chemotherapy. And I think the most important stressed point for all of these patients is that we still need to move this field forward, and wherever possible, we would want to enroll patients in clinical trials. The other drug that we need to keep our eyes on is this agent that we have listed here in third line called enfortumab vedotin. We expect that we'll have access to this and approval to this in the near future. It's still pending Health Canada approval, but it is a therapy that will probably be initially in the post-chemo and post-immunotherapy setting, so it will probably be a third-line treatment unless patients have had combination therapy upfront. So with that, I want to just talk a little bit about some of these new therapies for advanced bladder cancer. In the first line setting, we have obviously immunotherapy coming into the sphere. Remember, up until 2016, 2018, all we had available to us was chemo. And the first new kid on the block was immunotherapy. And where immunotherapy in the first line role can be seen is in patients who are not eligible for cisplatin, who are PD-L1 high. Again, we have Health Canada approval for agents in this space, such as pembrolizumab and atezo, but we don't have a funding decision that is positive at the level of the Pan-Canadian Oncology Drug Review. Whether that will change or be appealed or have further modifications to applications is something that we would remain to be seen, but right now there could potentially be a role if somebody had private insurance. In the second line setting, this is where immunotherapy has really become well established. This is for individuals who have previously had platinum-based combination chemotherapy, so they've received carboplatin or cisplatin in combination for metastatic disease, and then subsequently have had disease progression. That would be a very standard place where a drug like pembrolizumab would get used routinely in all centers across the country. And pembrolizumab is probably the favored agent in this space, just based upon the fact that there's a positive randomized phase 3 trial showing that it outperforms traditional chemotherapeutic agents. But this is also where we would expect that there could be a role to play for erdafitinib if an individual has progressed on chemotherapy and has that FGFR gene alteration. And then in the third line space, this is where I would envision enfortumab vedotin coming, which is a drug antibody conjugate where we link a chemotherapeutic agent to a drug conjugate that targets a protein called Nectin-4, and then can actually deliver that chemotherapy to the cell expressing the Nectin, which is effectively ubiquitously expressed on urothelial cancer. And it's a little bit more like a smart technology to deliver your chemo to the target. Where this will probably have its role to play initially is in patients who have progressed on chemo and on immunotherapy. And then we'll have decisions to make about whether you would choose enfortumab or erdafitinib, depending upon the patient's FGFR mutational status and preferences. So to summarize immunotherapy in urothelial carcinoma, the largest used agent by far is pembrolizumab based upon approvals and clinical trial data. If you're looking at pembrolizumab in the first line setting, it's somewhat of a theoretical approval because it's not funded. But you would be able to give it to people who are cisplatin ineligible and high PD-L1. If your patient is completely platinum ineligible, then they can receive it irrespective of their PD-L1 status because their options are so poor that the PD-L1 status doesn't really impact. In the second line setting, pembrolizumab is used widely in patients progressing beyond chemotherapy. And in the second line setting, there is no requirement for PD-L1 testing and no cutoffs for PD-L1 status to allow for use. Where we are looking for a lot more data readouts is in combination in first line, where we're giving chemotherapy and immunotherapy together. And we do have an interim readout already for the IMvigor 130 study, which was looking at chemotherapy with or without atezolizumab, including monotherapy atezolizumab. And we know that there is a positive result for progression-free survival, but still immature data for overall survival. And we're waiting to see how that will play out in the future in terms of how that combination may be used. Enfortumab is a drug that I've alluded to, and again, this is a drug antibody conjugate where you have a monoclonal antibody against this protein called Nectin-4, and you link it with a chemotherapeutic agent which works to disrupt microtubules. And that combination then can deliver your microtubule disrupting agent in high concentration to the urothelial cancer. Because this Nectin-4 is so ubiquitously expressed, it doesn't require biomarker testing. It's just expected that a bladder cancer is going to have Nectin-4 expression. So unlike some of the other drugs that we're talking about, like the FGFR inhibitor, erdafitinib, where you do need biomarker testing, in this case, you don't require a biomarker test for enfortumab. This drug is pending Health Canada submission and approval, and there are a whole host of trials that are still underway with enfortumab, including first-line studies where it will be combined with immunotherapy to see if this is a synergistic combination of giving upfront immunotherapy along with enfortumab. It's a very active drug, even in a very heavily pretreated population. In the EV-201 study, this is a patient trial which is not randomized. It's basically your treatment is driven by what prior therapies you've had. Everyone gets enfortumab. Some of these patients were in different cohorts based upon whether they were previously treated with immunotherapy or not. But even in third and fourth line settings where you would expect very minimal responses and very short survivals, you're seeing objective response rates of up to 45%, including 12% of patients with complete remissions where the disease is completely gone, which is quite impressive. And if you add together the 44% responses with another 28% of individuals with stable disease who have been progressing up to this point, you have a very highly active drug. On the right-hand side in the swimmer's plot, what we also see is that the responses, when they occur quickly around that two-month mark, which is important in a disease with like urothelial cancer where progressions are quick and patients are often quite symptomatic and don't have time to wait for a response to develop. The adverse events are kind of what you expect when you're giving chemotherapy. The good news is that there are very few grade 3 events, which are usually the types of side effects that I need to do something about. Grade 1, grade 2, the patient reports it, we dutifully document it, but we don't need to do a whole lot to action changes to the patient management. Common things being common with chemo, we see fatigue, hair loss, taste changes, as well as neuropathy, because it is a microtubule disrupting agent, so that's not surprising. So pretty standard fare for chemotherapy and well tolerated overall. Erdafitinib is the other new kid on the block, and we should take some time to just review some of their data. The BLC 2001 trial is a phase 2 open label study and is for individuals who have locally advanced or metastatic disease with prior progression after either one or more lines of chemotherapy. The other qualifier here is that patients can go on to these metastatic studies if they have had previous neoadjuvant or adjuvant chemo and have progressed within a year, and that's pretty standard. Typically, if you have progression within a year of neoadjuvant chemotherapy, what's recurring is disease that's chemo resistant, and you're not just going to proceed with more of the same. So in this particular study, you've all had chemotherapy, you may or may not have had immunotherapy, and now you're progressing again. You screen for FGFR mutation. If you have a mutation, then you went on to the trial. And the trial was looking at different dosing regimens. This is an oral medication. So you could look at the regimen 1 at the top center of the screen here, where it was a 1 week on, 1 week off schedule, or you may look at continuous dosing. And in this particular case, they did these two schedules. They did an interim analysis to look at pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics and tolerance, and subsequently moved on to regimen 3, which was the ultimate regimen where the patients received continuous dosing of 8 milligrams a day with the opportunity to go up a little bit to 9 milligrams a day if there was no excessive toxicity. The study shows us that these are pretty heavily pretreated patients. We've got a fairly good performance status for this group. So again, anytime you're doing a third and fourth line study, these patients are obviously selected well to be able to be fit enough to get to that point. So we always have to look at the generalizability to our global patient population. But you see that there's a large number of patients progressing after chemotherapy. So most people here have had chemotherapy. About a quarter of patients have also progressed after immunotherapy. So those are our two best treatment options at this point. And about half of the patient population have had two or more lines of prior therapy. So these are heavily pretreated patients, the vast majority of whom have visceral metastatic disease. And what we see is a quite impressive overall response rate here of 40%, including that we still see about 3% of patients having complete response where everything disappears. And the other thing that's quite impressive is that the responses are quick. It's about 1.4 months. So if you're going to respond to this agent, you're going to respond and you're going to see it quickly. So you're not going to have to wait around months and months and months to find out if you're going to get a patient who will respond. And the response rates were basically very similar, irrespective of the previous lines of chemotherapy, the previous numbers of other kinds of treatments that were administered, or the sites of distant metastatic disease, be it visceral or non-visceral. So essentially, you've got an active drug across the spectrum of the disease with regards to the prior lines of therapy and the sites of metastases, and a drug that responds quickly. If you take a look a little bit at some of these categories a little bit more in depth, what you'll see is that if you look at the rate of response, you can't really tease out any factors that would tell you that there's somebody who might not respond. So they'll respond whether they've had zero lines of prior therapy, up to four or more lines of prior therapy, whether they've had immunotherapy or not, whether they have liver disease or not. So essentially, you've got a patient population across the board that if they've got the mutation, then you have an opportunity to offer them a treatment which could have about a 40% response rate. This is the Kaplan-Meier plots of progression-free survival and overall survival. And what I would highlight is that in a patient population that is predominantly third and fourth line, we would normally expect from other trial data that even in the second line setting, you might only have overall survivals that are 9 to 10 months and progression-free survivals of 3 or 4. Here you're seeing progression-free survival medians of around 6 months, and you're seeing a median overall survival that's out around a year. And so once again, highly selected patients that can make it onto these trials. But nonetheless, when you look at this type of data, you would say that this is clearly an active agent that warrants further review, further trialing, for example, in other lines of therapy or in other potential combinations. Now, every time we get a new class of agent, we have to learn to deal with a whole bunch of new side effects, things that might be slightly different than what we're used to dealing with. So now we've got a new agent which has a different profile than things that perhaps we're used to dealing with on an everyday basis. One of the things that's interesting is it causes hyperphosphatemia. It prevents us from excreting phosphate. So we do develop higher levels of serum phosphate. And that is one of the dose-limiting toxicities and one of the things I'll mention in a couple of slides about how you might monitor and dose adjust. It does cause skin events, specifically to your hand and feet, so you get a hand-foot syndrome, which medical oncologists are used to managing from other agents such as the tyrosine kinase inhibitors and kidney cancer, but it also causes nail events, onycholysis, paronychia. These may sound not like big deals, you know, it's not like febrile neutropenia and sepsis, but a chronic nail dystrophy or a chronic paronychia will be a big quality of life issue for a patient. And therefore, we do need to monitor for the development of these chronic toxicities because something that's chronic for the patient will have impacts on quality of life. Central serous retinopathy is something which I would say most of us probably have never even heard of before looking at some of these trial data. And it does happen in about a fifth of all patients who are on these agents. Fortunately, there are only a few people who experience a high-grade CSR, and I'll tell you about this in the next couple of slides. And the good news is that as long as we think of systems that we can put in place for monitoring and partnering with optometry and ophthalmology, if this toxicity develops, you basically stop the drug and the body can heal itself. So what we need to do is simply have systems in place to allow for monitoring, which will probably mean partnering outside of the typical clinical environment where we work with, because I don't have an optometrist that I call every day to manage patients in my clinic. But if I have somebody that will partner with me for some of these agents, we know that we probably have someone we can call. So in conclusion, this trial did meet its primary endpoint. They were looking for a 25% response rate. They achieved a 40% response rate. The dosing that was chosen was this 8 milligram day dosing continuously with the opportunity to dose escalate into a 9 milligram a day dosing. The responses are rapid. They're independent of the numbers of lines of therapy and independent of the tumor burden, with a reasonably exciting PFS and overall survival of more than a year in this very heavily pretreated population. Adverse events are for the most part low grade, manageable, and basically the treatment of the adverse event is withholding the medication until resolution and considering reintroducing the drug at a lower dose. So it certainly has benefit in this patient population with the appropriate mutation. So to flesh out a little bit more about the nuts and bolts of this drug, the recommended dose of erdafitinib is to start off at 8 milligrams a day, which can be broken up into these 2 4-milligram tablets, and you take it once a day with food. And we would counsel patients in conjunction with our dietitians to reduce the amount of phosphate that they're taking in their diets, because we know they're going to retain phosphate, and that's one of the toxicities of the agent. It should be noted that there are multiple different tablet preparations, so as I show you some dose modifications of going up or going down, there will be opportunities to have different pill formulations so that you can target your dosing to the number of milligrams per day that the patient requires. We would not be cutting pills, for example. As to our per usual pharmacy guidelines, if you vomit the dose, you don't take another one. If you miss a dose, you try to take it as quickly as possible. And effectively, we treat until progression. The dosing changes will most of the time be driven by phosphate levels. This particular slide has US units. On another slide, I'll show you the SI units. But normally a phosphate on our normal chemistries is between about 0.8 to 1.5 millimole per liter. And once you start getting above that, then you start getting into the grade 1, 2, 3 toxicities. And what you're essentially doing is adjusting and holding the dose to try to keep the patient at a minimally elevated phosphate level, if not a normal phosphate level. As I mentioned, CSR is probably the one toxicity which would give me personally a little bit of cause for concern, just because I've never seen it and wouldn't know what I'm doing about it. And that's where you would simply partner with an optometrist or an ophthalmologist. It doesn't have to be ophthalmology, it can be optometry, because they would have all the necessary equipment to be able to do a good examination. This is essentially a condition where fluid accumulates under the retina. And if unchecked, it basically will peel the retina off and you'll lose vision. Patients may show no symptoms, however, but the optometrist with the appropriate equipment would be able to see where there's fluid buildup occurring in the eye, which would be an asymptomatic development of this toxicity, which could then be fed back to the treating physician to hold the medication. For the most part, you don't need to do anything about this because it will resolve on its own if you just stop giving the drug. In cases where there is a more high-grade problem or it's not regressing on its own, then there may be requirement for treatment by a retinal specialist with things such as laser. So you do have to have a baseline eye exam prior to the initiation of therapy. And it is recommended for the first month that somebody do a good ophthalmologic assessment. This will include visual acuity, a slit lamp exam, fundoscopy, and optical coherence tomography. Effectively, these are tools that can be done in any optometrist's office. So you don't necessarily need to have them going through an ophthalmologist, but before you embarked on a treatment program, you would want to set up a partnership with an optometrist or an ophthalmologist who had the equipment and have the interest. And in oncology spheres, we are now dealing with a whole bunch of new agents coming onto the market that often have eye toxicities. And this is actually an area of big interest in the optometry community, who are asking for example, oncology in-services and educational events to talk about eye toxicity of oncologic agents. The management is outlined for you here on this slide. For an individual who is asymptomatic, so the optometrist calls me up and says, I see early changes of CSR, but the patient is completely normal. Basically, what I'm going to do is I'm going to pick up the phone, I'm going to call the patient and say, hold your medication. Your optometry assessment is going to be done again in approximately a month. And if everything is stable and it's not recurring, then you would be able to consider restarting the medication. If you continue to have delays and recur in resolution, you may continue the medication, but at a lower dose. Effectively, as you get a higher and higher grade, you're just going to be more conservative with your resumption of the medication. So if my patient has visual changes, they hold the drug until they get better, and then they start at a lower dose. If they've got really bad vision changes, they start two doses lower. And if they've got terrible vision changes, you're going to permanently discontinue the medication. So effectively, you just have to have ongoing communication back and forth with the optometrist about whether or not there are any eye changes that are occurring, with a conversation with the patient if they're having side effects. For phosphate levels, this is where you'll see the SI units are on this diagram. If the upper limit of normal is around 1.6, for example, millimole per liter for your phosphate, if it's a grade 1 where it's 1.8 to 2.3, you don't need to do anything. You just carry on with the drug. If it creeps a little higher, then you withhold the drug. And when the blood work normalizes, you can resume at the same dose with close monitoring. Or if it's slow to resolve, you would start again at a lower dose. And the higher the phosphate levels, basically, the lower the dosing. When you would resume, you would either start one or two doses lower than the normal starting dose. And I'll show you what that starting dose and dose reduction scheme looks like in a second. So in general, the treatment of these toxicities, the scary one I think for us to think about because we're not used to it is the eye. And I think it's reassuring to know this is typically self-limiting. It's an issue of recognition that it can occur. So if you have a monitoring program in place and you find that its CSR has developed, you stop the medication and let the retina heal itself. And as the retina heals itself, things stabilize. And if the ophthalmologist involved at the time feels that the patient isn't resolving quickly enough, then they may consider doing some type of photodynamic therapy or laser treatment. Now, the dose modifications are noted here on the bottom of the slide. Remember that the starting dose is 8 milligrams a day. If after you've been monitoring the patient for the first couple of weeks and their phosphate levels aren't out of control and they have no other toxicities, you can go to 9 milligrams a day, but that's where you stop. That's the max. And now you can see here that the dose reductions are laid out so that if you were someone starting at 8 milligrams, your first dose reduction is to 6, then it goes to 5, then it goes to 4, and then you have to stop. And basically, if you're starting at 9, you just have a little bit more wiggle room that you drop to 8, then 6, 5, 4. As I mentioned, when we come to the point of having access to this medication through access programs, we would have all of these different tablet strengths at the specialty pharmacies, and we would simply need to identify what strength or what dose we want the patient to receive per day, and then they can appropriately figure out what type of pills to be sent to the patient. So we're not worrying about trying to cut tablets in half or do other things like that. So if I go back to Robert, if we go to his story again, he was a guy who had muscle invasive disease and he had a number of treatment options at his disposal. And what he chose to do was a radical cystectomy and he had neoadjuvant chemotherapy. Now in this case, the oncologist had asked for FGFR testing to be done up front. And we knew from that particular situation that he came back as being positive for an FGFR mutation. So you can keep that information in your back pocket. Unfortunately, within 6 months of his surgery, he develops metastatic disease and he's got lung involvement as well as lymph nodes and bone involvement. So we've got a number of treatment options that we could look at. We have second line chemo. We have immunotherapy, we have erdafitinib, enfortumab, or clinical trial. And as a medical oncologist working in an academic center, I'm always going to push the clinical trial, because if we don't do clinical trials, we're never going to move the needle on any of our diseases. But if you think about other options here, second-line chemotherapy, well, yeah, you could give chemotherapy again, but we know that in randomized clinical trials for patients who have progressed within 1 year of neoadjuvant chemotherapy, or basically that's the same as progressing on first-line metastatic treatment, second-line chemo actually loses in any number of randomized clinical trials. So it would be an option if nothing else was doable. In the Canadian context today, he would certainly get immunotherapy as a second-line therapy because he's progressed within a year of neoadjuvant treatment, and most places would offer this man pembrolizumab. But knowing that he's got an FGFR mutation, he could qualify for erdafitinib since he has progressed within that 1 year of the neoadjuvant treatment. But right now, we would not have access to a drug like enfortumab, and the enfortumab approvals are initially going to be in post-chemo and immunotherapy settings. So that would be something reserved for a later line of therapy. So his best two options, really, if you don't have a clinical trial, are to consider immunotherapy or erdafitinib. And the logical question you might ask is, well, which is best? And truth be told, we don't know. And a lot of what we're going to do will be dependent upon patient preferences, access, and local factors that might impact what you can do in your region. So as far as our guidance recommendations for biomarker testing, first of all, we have to remember that while this is very exciting data and we are glad that we have another option on the table, the number of people who are going to have a mutation that we can work with and have an option is still relatively low. And in the metastatic disease space, we're looking at approximately 22 to 25% of individuals that are going to have a mutation that we can work with that will allow us to have access to the erdafitinib. PD-L1 biomarker expression was a big topic of debate from our working groups, because a lot of people said, right now, if we don't need biomarker testing for PD-L1 for second-line treatment because it doesn't make a difference, and if we don't have access to agents in the first-line space because they're not funded, do you need it? Why we felt that it would be important to put in is because in the future, we expect further data to arrive from these chemoimmunotherapy studies where we're giving chemo plus or minus an immunologic agent up front. And all of those trials are going to have data that come out on whether or not there's differential response rates and survival based upon PD-L1 expression. So therefore, there may be in the future patient selection that's driven by the presence of high PD-L1 or not, and we want to get ahead of that curve and look at that patient population who is at high risk for the development of metastatic disease and get that biomarker testing underway upfront. Again, in first line, we need PD-L1 if you wanted to try to use these immunotherapy agents for people who are cisplatin ineligible but carbo-eligible who are high PD-L1. And in the second line setting, we don't need a PD-L1 expression level to qualify for immune therapy. So if I have a man sitting in front of me, if Robert's in my clinic tomorrow and I have to think about second, third, and beyond lines of therapy, how am I going to choose and how am I going to individualize that therapy? And obviously, clinicians have to know what all the options are, but we have to feel confident and comfortable in using those agents. So things that we will look at in the clinic are going to be the level of evidence in terms of whether we feel confident that this is a single arm phase 2 study versus a randomized phase 3. We're also going to look at the clinical trial characteristics to make sure that the patient that's sitting in front of us actually is the same kind of patient that was in that clinical trial, because you can't look a guy in the eye and promise him benefit if he would have never qualified for the study in the first place. And perhaps this is where we start to color outside the lines a little bit more than maybe we should. We also have to look at the options available. Are there absolute contraindications? For example, active autoimmune disease, which will mean I can't use immunotherapy. And then there are going to be very practical things that we're going to look at. What's the route of administration? Some people are going to refuse IV and they're only going to want pills. Some people are going to live very remotely and they're going to have a hard time making it in for an intravenous infusion appointment once a week if you were thinking of giving a drug like enfortumab. And then finally, we have to look at regional differences. So there are going to be funding differences and subtleties in provinces where perhaps the order of events that you give people therapy may directly impact their eligibility for future lines of treatment. And it's not going to necessarily be wide open that will fund three lines of treatment, but you may actually see restrictions on what you can get in one disease entity in one province versus another based upon how those administrations in those provinces view the data. So there will always have to be local decision-making by local experts. If I'm talking to Robert and discussing with him the possibility of embarking on immunotherapy, what I'm going to say to him is that there are phase three data that support the use of immunotherapy in your kind of situation. And it's actually rare in 2020 for us to have an absolute contraindication to immunotherapy. We know that there's very strict criteria on clinical trials, and when you get into the real world, you tend to push the envelope a little bit. And once you have a bit of experience with these people, you can actually still treat some people with a history of autoimmune disease if you carefully select them and if you're open with the patient about the possibility of flaring of their autoimmune disease. I'm certainly a lot more worried if somebody had Crohn's disease, for example, than perhaps if they had, you know, a little bit of a skin rash from some psoriasis that never really bothers them. But we also have to remember that although there's a lot of hype and the patients love the concept of immunotherapy, progressive disease is still the most common response. In other words, a significant majority of people don't respond to immunotherapy. The problem is we don't know who they are that are going to get the wonderful responses. And so most of the time, because the drugs are well tolerated and they can respond beautifully, we like to give our patients the opportunity to get exposed to those drugs. However, some people are against the concept of IV treatment. The treatments are somewhat indefinite, although in pembrolizumab studies, they often quit at 2 years because beyond that, they did not think that there was going to be significant benefit. But still, 2 years of treatment every 3 weeks for intravenous treatment is a significant quality of life burden. The flip side for Robert is that he does have an FGFR mutation. And so what are my considerations for offering him erdafitinib? Well, he does qualify because he's been post-platinum treatment and he's progressed. It is an oral agent, which does simplify things for the booking of administration of chemocheratime, for example. However, I need an optometrist or an ophthalmologist on speed dial. I need to have that working relationship with them, and I need to have a compliant patient who's going to go for his blood work so I can check his phosphate and who's going to report to me if he notices any changes in his vision. So all of these things require a compliant patient with fairly ready access to the clinic where they can be seen and who is willing to work closely with their treatment team at the beginning as we all gain experience with these medications. But the good news is that it responds quickly. We often see early on again in that first couple of months if the patient's going to benefit. And if we can dose titrate to find that manageable level of toxicity for benefit ratio, you could get a lot of good mileage out of this oral agent. So if I just finish up a little bit with testing, because this is now a new sphere for us, and it's going to require urology input because those are the professionals who are procuring the tissue. So what we're asking for in our algorithm is for consideration of reflex testing in people who have had their cystectomy and have high-risk features. So irrespective of whether or not the patient has had chemotherapy, we could still identify a group of individuals with high-risk features. Those who have neoadjuvant treatment who are still persistently T2 or higher probably warrant reflex testing. Those who have not had neoadjuvant chemotherapy, if they're T3, T4, or node positive, they will require reflex testing. That requires a coordinated effort with pathology so that the pathologist will send it off. And this is done already in a whole host of other disease entities such as lung cancer and breast cancer. We're just introducing it into a new area. There will also be a need for a physician to be able to do on-demand testing, where perhaps this is a newly diagnosed patient who's never had a cystectomy, but he has metastatic disease and will have to request the test. That would not be reflex testing. It would be up to the surgeon who's doing the biopsy to indicate to the pathologist that you want PD-L1 testing. Considerations for FGFR testing is that this is not reflex in the sense that we are going to ask for on-demand testing at the time that the patient is going to be initiating first-line metastatic therapy. So remember, in the pathology bank, there's going to be a cystectomy specimen or a TUR specimen, but the pathologist is never going to know when a patient is going to initiate therapy. So it would be up to me as an oncologist initiating first-line therapy for metastatic disease to pick up the phone and call the lab and say, I need on-demand testing for FGFR alteration, so that by the time I need to consider my second-line therapy, the tissue result is back. It is preferred that we use FFPE blocks, and the pathologist will require specific requirements to be able to send to reference laboratories. And so we will be creating a tear-off sheet for pathology that will indicate what's required and where to send it. And geographically across the country, there are going to be centers that will send their specimens to the Jewish General in Montreal and others that will send it to the University Health Network in Toronto. And these tear-off sheets will tell the pathologist exactly how to requisition the test, interpretation of the test, specimens for shipment, and where they go to and how to ship them, and basically how to direct the local pathology staff to obtain the right requisitions to send it off to the reference labs, because at the start there will only be two reference labs nationally. And quickly, one slide to get your juices flowing for the future, what's coming, or a couple of slides. Further erdafitinib trials are underway in advanced urothelial carcinoma. Once this NORSE study goes through its phase 1b component to do dose finding, this will be an exciting study combining erdafitinib with an immunotherapeutic agent. J&J 283 is an immunotherapy, a checkpoint inhibitor. So we'll be looking at combinations of erda with IO. And similarly, in people who have previously been treated for metastatic disease, whether they've had chemo or IO or both, this will be a large randomization between the prior lines of therapy. So if people have never had immunotherapy before, the randomization is between erdafitinib or IO, because right now pembro would be a standard of care in the second line setting. And if they have already had immunotherapy, so it's kind of a third line treatment, then it's erdafitinib versus chemotherapy. And then we are waiting for a large number of clinical trials to report out further data. IMvigor 130 has already reported a progression-free survival benefit, but we're still waiting for overall survival. But there are other trials looking at chemotherapy with immunotherapy, including as combinational strategies, or in the Javelin study, it is a maintenance strategy where people given chemotherapy who respond are randomized to immunotherapy versus observation. And we're hoping that multiple numbers of these studies could report out in the next year or two. And I think from an area GU cancer where there was nothing going on for years, to know that there are over 60 clinical trials with urothelial carcinoma in phase 3 or phase 4 is incredibly encouraging. So in summary, there are newly approved therapies coming into this space to help fill an unmet need, all of which we're hoping will improve progression-free and overall survival. The GE Research Consortium has developed this algorithm to try to incorporate how we would be requesting and looking at biomarkers in clinical practice, and including now that we have an FGFR inhibitor with erdafitinib, which will have a place in our patient treatment algorithm. As we use this drug and get comfortable, we do have to have local policies and procedures in place to help work with our colleagues in ophthalmology and work with our pathology partners to figure out that FGFR testing piece and the ultimate development of reflex testing for PD-L1. All of this means it's a team sport. Early referral, team collaboration, so that the patients have access to these therapies as quickly as possible. And again, if you have any questions about this presentation and or feedback, Tal Erdman at the CUA is there to take your comments. And with that, I will open it up to questions.
Are you getting FGFR testing as part of a hotspot panel or NGS right now?
Presently, we are not across the country. Depending upon different platforms that people are using as part of, for example, phase one trials, they may be receiving it as part of their report back. But right now, it's not a usual part of the analyses. Some people are looking at genomic health to get their results back, for example, and we are starting to see it become more reported. But specifically for access in Canada through these programs, we will have to access the centralized testing through the Jewish General or the University Health Network in order to have the result from that, which could help us to access the agent. So we will not be able to use any other third-party testing for drug access. While we're waiting for that, I'll just again remind everybody that there is an access program that's opening up in this area. So if an individual with metastatic disease is someone who a clinician feels may be appropriate for treatment with an FGFR inhibitor, there will be opportunities to send that tissue off to the testing facilities that will be linked with your geographic region. And then from there, if the FGFR mutation is demonstrated, there would then be an access program for medication to be available for the patient. And these programs are just getting up and running across the country, as this is just something that's brand new for 2020.
Not seeing any other questions coming through.
Perfect. All right, well, if that's the case, then I'd like to just thank all those online for their time this evening. Hopefully you found this useful, and if you have comments or feedback, please feel free to contact the CUA. They are always open to your feedback for improvement for programs, as well as general topics for what you feel is interesting for you.
Thank you, Dr. North, and thank you everyone for joining this evening.
Good evening.